ॐ भरताय प्रतिपूजितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धतामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी. Sarvabhutasthitam yo mam, bhajatyekatvamastitah, astitah, sarvatha vartamanopi, sayogi mayi vartate, sarva bhuta stitam yaha mam bhajati ekatvam astitah sarvata vartamanah api saha yogi mayi vartate. It's really giving now in these next verses the pola. The moksha pala, the pala of moksha for the one who has nishta. Really beautiful. So he says, sarva bhuta stitam mam yaha bhajati yaha ekatvam astitaha yaha ekatvam astitaha. These are the nominative singulars. The one who is astitaha, placed in, abiding in the ekatvam, the oneness, means recognizing oneness, the ekatvam. That one, bhajati, obtains, meaning gains the vision, obtains mam, obtains me, who is sarva-bhuta stitam, abiding in all beings, sarva-bhuta, all beings, stitam, one who's placed there, abiding as the self in all beings, the one who's abiding there in all beings, that one who is astitaha, remaining in that oneness, that one, bhajati, or bhajate, bhajati, that one gains me. And then that one who's gained me, the one who's abiding in all beings, that one who has recognized the oneness, the Advaita, the one who's recognized the oneness, who's abiding in all beings, then for that person, sarvata vartamanopi, sarvata vartamanaha api, saha yogihi, that yogi. So yogi, that yogi means the one who has this jnana-nishta, the one who has recognize the self. That's yogi here. Saha yogi, that yogi. Sarvata vartamanah api. No matter what he or she is doing. Sarvata means in whatever manner. Vartamanah, existing. In whatever manner they're existing. In whatever lifestyle or whatever situation they find themselves in. So sarvata means in all ways. Literally it means sarvata, that ta affix means in all manner, in all ways. So it's an indeclinable, in all ways, vartamanaha api, existing even in any way at all, wherever this their situation may be, that yogi, mayi vartate, that yogi remains in me. Mayi in me, vartate remains. Right, so that's the very, that's advice, that's this, that's moksha. It is not about the lifestyle or the situation, you know, and it doesn't matter. And that's true on every level. It's not even about the mind. Now, it's not about the situation of the mind. As we'll see in the next verse, it's not about sukha and dukkha. It's not about the lifestyle that you find yourself in. It's not about the situation that you find yourself in. Otherwise, you have to say, in order for me to have jnana-nishta, in order for me to really abide in this knowledge, I need a particular lifestyle. You know? In order for me to be a truly a jnani, I need to be a sannyasi living in the Himalayas in my little grass hut, right next to the Ganga. You're in the Himalayas, you know. And having my bhiksha served to me every day. Whatever my fantasy may be, it's not that those aren't beautiful fantasies. But does the lifestyle or the situation that you find yourself in necessary for your jnana nishtha? Is yourself only present in a given lifestyle? You know, that's the thing. You go into this lifestyle and then myself becomes manifest to me. But if I go into this lifestyle, myself is not manifest to me. If you even have that type of thinking, we're looking at the Atma as an antakarana vritti, as a thought modification in the mind. We're not recognizing the self that is pervasive to every vritti, the self that is the self of all beings, the self that is the self of all places. You know, that lanta, if you go to the moon and back, yourself is already there. It doesn't matter where in the creation you are, the self is already there. It doesn't matter in the creation, whatever you are doing, whatever you find yourself doing. You know, you could be a cook, or you could be a waitress. You know, you could be a hobo, or you could be a sadhu. Or you could be a king like Janaka. They always use the example of Janaka in the Upanishads, who was a great jnani and a great king. You know, great king means of his kingdom he had incredible responsibilities. He ruled his kingdom. He was also a great jnani. You can be a householder, you can be a mother, you can be a father, you can be old, you can be young, you can be living in a retirement home. It doesn't make any difference at all, you know. In fact, there's such a freedom in that recognition that your knowledge and your freedom is not defined by what you are doing. You know? And what you are doing doesn't necessarily in any way help your knowledge. Because once you have knowledge, I mean, until you have knowledge, you need to protect it by shravana, manana, nididhyasana. You need to be in a situation where your knowledge is protected so that you can grow in that knowledge. You know, so then you could say, if you're in that situation where you're still gaining your nishtha and gaining your strength and working through your complexes, and so that your buddhi, your mind still has to become strong, you know, strong to be able to handle your complexes, to mentor them, you know, to mentor them, to raise them, to be kind to them, to be an inner friend. You're still working on developing that strength. And you're still working on developing your strength of knowledge, your clarity of knowledge. And so in that situation, you know, your situation is important because it contains you and holds you and protects you. You know, Swamiji uses the example always of if you plant a little tree, you know, in your garden, initially you have to put some, you know, fencing around the tree, some protection around the tree to protect it. So that it can grow and flourish. Because initially it's too weak and the animals can come and just rip it out or eat it or whatnot. But after a while, as that tree is nourished and cared for, it becomes so strong, you know, it grows right through the fence and becomes so strong that it doesn't need protection. And in fact, others seek it for protection. They seek it for shade. They sit around the tree. They enjoy the shade of the tree, the protection of the tree. Now that tree doesn't have to protect itself anymore. In fact, it protects others. It cares for others. And so knowledge is like that too. When that nishtha, that rootedness comes, that clarity comes, then whatever is going on in your mind, whether it be sukha, dukkha, whether it be good or bad, your buddhi, your knowledge, who you are, your knowledge and who you are can hold that. You hold that situation. Your mind is a situation. We have to look at the world as a situation. We have to look at our mind as a situation too. And the mind is a situation that you can't get away from. You can get away from the situation in the world. You can turn your back on it and walk away and, you know, dump it. Try to anyway. And then try to move into another situation. No, you can't do that with your mind. And so your mind will just go follow right along with you. You know? And so that's why, even though we need that kaushalam for being able to have the kind of the strength and the clarity and the vairagya, all of these things that are about nishta, to handle the external situation, we have to handle the internal situation too, which can bring up all kinds of, as Swamiji said, all kinds of funny thoughts. So I've had all kinds of funny thoughts. Unexpected thoughts. I mean, you've taken thousands and so much input. You can have any innumerable thoughts can take place or can even be triggered. That's not a problem. The problem is, who are you? How does your buddhi, how does your mind hold those thoughts? Are you as compassionate, and do you have as much objectivity toward this thought as toward that thought? Toward this situation as toward that situation? Is that compassion and objectivity there? That's nishta, that's what we grow into, to where the buddhi itself isn't shakable. The buddhi can hold the situation. And what is holding the buddhi is the self. What holds the buddhi, what makes the buddhi so-called unshakable, is the atma, the self which is unshakable. If the self never changes, it has no distance between, there's no distance between your mind and the self. The self is unshakable. It's just, is the mind, you know, is the buddhi awake to that self to the degree that it can hold all of the different things that the mind and the world throws at you. It's coming from inside. Your experiences, the experiences of the jagat, of the creation, are coming from inside and from outside. You know, they're coming here, and they're coming here. And so all of them are experiences, and some of them are sukha, sukha-generating experiences, some are dukkha-generating experiences. So how are we with those experiences? For the one who has nishta, you know, how they say here in this verse, the one who is astita. Stitaha means to, comes from sta, means to stand in, to remain, to be placed. So the one who is placed, that the ah is emphasis, who is well placed there, you know, well placed in what? The ekatvam, the oneness. You're one, well, now, so now when we bring in this word oneness, okay, there's a recognition of the atma, and the Atma who is the self of all beings. And when you say oneness, now we're not just looking at the stability of the Atma. Oneness means Advaita, Ekatvam. One alone. One alone. One without a second. That means all of this is one. So you can say, I am the self in all beings. So the one abiding in that Ekatvam, he attains me, me meaning Ishwara, who is the self of all beings, right? And so this Atma becomes the Atma of the creation. This Atma that I am is your Atma. There's all this Dvaita, that Swamiji talks about this in his Bhasha. The Dvaita is like this. There is a Dvaita for the Ajnani, between myself and Ishwara. The Ajnani is not going to say, I am Ishwara. In fact, actually, I've told the story before when I was around 18, when one young man looked at me and all kind of goo-goo-eyed and said, I am God. I am God. And he was kind of a, you know, in some sort of a, got involved in some Eastern thing. So he said, I am God. And I thought, yeah, right. Sure you are. Sure you are. And I disappeared. You know, I had no interest in pursuing the conversation at all. You know, Ajnani is not that he was some jnani. I doubt it. I think he was just talking. You know, but I don't really know. But nevertheless, I certainly didn't fall into it. That's the Dvaita. Here is the God, and then there's me. I'm not God. Christ Dwaita. I'm limited, God is limitless. Then between you and me, Jiva and Jiva, well, I'm not you. Somebody comes along and says, I am you. No, you're not. I'm me, you're you. I am not you. Dwaita. Then there's Dwaita between Jiva and Jagat, Jiva and the creation. Can you say, I am the creation? You wouldn't say, I am the creation. You know, I'm an individual in the creation. How can you say, I am the creation? There's a problem there also between myself being a sentient being and the creation that I experience being inert. You know? So there's difference between sentient and sentient. Right, I'm a sentient being, you're a sentient being. That's two, that's not one. And then there's a difference between I'm a sentient being and the creation is inert. I'm a pocket of consciousness, one of the many pockets of consciousness, walking around in this insentient creation. That's Dwaita. And then, of course, there's the limited and the limitless. There's that Jiva, Ishwara, Dwaita. So the individual, the mumukshu, the samsari, turned the samsari and or the mumukshu, is living in a world of absolute duality, of absolute difference. We're so happy to have you because you make us happy. That's why. Absolute difference. So here it's ekatvam astitaha. The one whose vision is ekatvam. That's ekatvam between the oneness between Jiva and Ishwara. Oneness between Jiva and Jiva. Oneness between Jiva and Jagat. What is that ekatvam? Is the one who sees that sees me as the self of all beings. Now, also if you say like this, Bhagavan is saying, speaking as he's speaking as is Ishwara, the one who sees me as the self of all beings. That means myself too. That means that Ishwara is myself, is yourself, is yourself, is yourself, is yourself, is yourself, is Tibby's self, is the ant self, is the animal's self, is the self of all beings. So this self that I am, is this self that you are, is the self that you are, is the self that Ishwara is. And so the one who recognizes that self, that in fact can't be objectified, because if you were to objectify the Atma, then there's difference. The instant, like for instance, if I say, if Bhagavan says, you know, I am the one who is the self in all beings, that means myself is yourself, is yourself, is yourself. Well, the only thing about us that can be the same is the self that can't be objectified. Because if you look at everything else, it's not the same. My body is not your body. My sense organs are not your sense organs. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My mind is not your mind. My emotions are not your emotion. My ahankara is not your ahankara. My memories are not your memories. My ignorance is not your ignorance. You have your own set, I've got mine. My knowledges are not your knowledges. We are unique in our collection of experiences. They are not the same. They're different. And so there is no oneness or identity there. The oneness is only in me, in the conscious being that I am, that is not objectifiable. It's objectifiable, you know, you objectify yourself, I objectify mine, we're in duality immediately. So that I am is a word. That's a vritti, I am. If you say I am. Even if you say, I'm a conscious being, those are words. But those words are descriptive, are pointing to me, the conscious being, which is not a word. Consciousness is not a word. There's a word for consciousness, but consciousness is not a word. There's a word for being, for existence, but existence is not a word. Right? The word points to the being, the existence, I am, which is yourself. So once you say, which is yourself, there can't be a separation between selves. If there's a separation between selves, then we're in duality again. We're objectifying it. And so this being that I am is not something that is delineated by time and by space and by objectivity. You know, it doesn't have a right side or a left side or an up or a down. That all exists within duality, within space. But myself is the stable one in whom duality takes place. I am the stable one that illumines duality. I am the stable one that lends its existence to duality. But for me, for consciousness itself, there's no objectification to make it dual. That's the aparokshatvam. I can't look at myself. I'm self-evident. I don't need to look at myself in order to be myself. I don't need to look at myself to be conscious. I need to look at the painting in order to know the painting, but I don't need to look at myself to know myself. Myself is its own light. That's what we mean by, you know, self-evident, self-conscious itself, self-luminous. So now, this self, once I have recognized myself, I'm abiding in that oneness, then abiding in that oneness, that recognition, you know, having recognized that oneness which is me, and of course which is you, and which is all experience, then is there anything that I have to do? Is there any special occupation I need to have, you know, in order to be that? Is it dependent? Is my knowledge, is myself dependent upon any particular job or any particular lifestyle or any particular age or gender? Is it dependent on anything like that? It can't be. If it's dependent on something like that, there's no ekatvam, there's no advaita. Right? If you're dependent on a job, if your being is dependent on a job and has some association with that job, or that job is somehow conducive to you, it means you haven't recognized yourself. Yourself is the self of every vritti that you've ever had. Yourself is the self of every job you've ever had. You know, it's the self of every experience that you've ever had. And so there's nothing, there is no experience that exists in the creation that is away from that self. And so if you know that self, it doesn't matter what the vrittis are or what is going on in the creation. That self is the self of that, whatever it may be. And so once you recognize that self, there is no vritti, no situation, no thought that can take you away from it, because it is the self of every thought. It is the self of every experience. So the one who knows that, no matter what they're doing, nothing can take, Krishna is talking, nothing can take them away from me. They remain in me. Why? Because I am them, and there is nothing but me. I not only am you, but I'm everyone else also. Right? I'm the self of all that there is. And so no matter what you're doing, who you're relating to, or what the situation is, yourself is not taken away, nor is it touched. It's the very self of that situation. So that the one who has nishta, right? The one who has that nishta, that is your experiential reality, because in fact that is the truth. And when you recognize yourself, that's what you recognize. You recognize it, oh, I'm stable. I'm always here. You can't do anything about it. I can't do anything about it. Where the sadhana comes in is that because of our likes and dislikes, our raga dvesha, you know, that jivatvam, that dvaita comes back. I'm not abiding in that ekatvam anymore. The raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, bring back, you know, the jiva, as though I want this, I need this. In order to be happy, that person's, the head rises of that person. And then my complex is that because of my growing up, all kinds of notions and complexes that come in and overwhelm the buddhi. They overwhelm the buddhi. It's like the little tree, it's too windy out. You know? And the little tree gets blown about. The buddhi gets blown about by these situations where I have a lack of vairagya. You know, I need the situation to be this way, not that way. It's lack of vairagya, so I get blown about. Or my complexes, I have not the buddhi has not become strong enough to be able to hold the complexes. You know, like holding a child. Or holding, being able to, in the world, to be able to hold with equipoise a very difficult person. You know, that's not easy. For the buddhi to not become overwhelmed or resist if there's a very difficult person in the world that you have to deal with who doesn't like you for this reason or whatever it is. That's very, very challenging. So the buddhi can kind of become overwhelmed and head for the hills. It's the same, you know, with your complexes, the buddhi can become overwhelmed because it hasn't had, it needs to still grow. It needs to grow in strength. And the complexes also, as they get assimilated in your knowledge, they also give up a lot of their energy. They release a lot of energy, so they become, the complexes become easier to handle, and your buddhi becomes stronger. Both are happening at the same time. And so these complexes or structures or ways of relating to the world lose their hold. Slowly they lose their hold. And then because of lack of vairagya, because as I gain in vairagya, the world loses its hold. The lack of vairagya is just simply this. It's not trying to get rid of anything. It's that this, I need it to be a certain way to be happy, becomes that notion, becomes less and less and less. It's replaced more and more and more with just the natural, this is fine as it is. In other words, where I'm not viewing my situations in terms of my likes and dislikes. I'm viewing my situations in terms of the situation that's here before me. So, and that's different. Like when you're dealing with the life that's here before you, the situation that's here before you, just in terms of the situation that's here, not whether or not it is making me happy or sad, but that's not the criteria. What the criteria is that this is my situation. Then there's vairagya in reference to that. You know, because then I have objectivity. I'm just doing the best I can in the situation, trying to make it work, whatever I can contribute, that type of thing. It doesn't, it's not, you know, highly charged. But then there's those situations that where there's not that vairagya. It's like this situation is causing me a great deal of pain. You know, or this situation is causing me a great deal of happiness. You know, if it's causing a great deal of happiness, that's also a problem because this happiness that I'm experiencing is finite because it's born of a situation. So if there's vairagya, you can enjoy the situation as it is, but there's not that sense of, I need this to continue. It's not that I have this kind of, you know, stay away happiness, nor do I have this stay away sorrow. We don't view the world in terms of raga dvesha. We view the world in terms of the situation that is before me. And then that way, that's Ishvara. That's easy to have the Ishvara buddhi because the jiva hasn't risen its head when it's brought about by the raga dvesha. As soon as the raga dvesha is there, these likes and dislikes are there, then there comes the jiva because when I say raga dvesha, I mean the jiva's raga dvesha. I need this to be happy. Then the jiva's head is there. But when I'm not viewing the world in that way, I have objectivity toward the world, then there's a certain, you know, objectivity and I can see the Ishvara buddhi is there. The Ekatva buddhi is there. Because that's my knowledge. I have that knowledge, and the raga dveshas are not in the way, and the complexes have not overwhelmed the buddhi. When that's the case, then whether the complexes are there, or whatever the situation may be, that ekatva buddhi is there, and there's no sense of self-loss. There's no sense of remoteness. There's no remoteness anyway. There's never a remoteness of myself. It's just whether or not the situation can make me seem to have, seem to be covered over. Those seeming occurrences will, if for a person who has knowledge but their mind is still maturing, these seeming occurrences come and go. You know, if it's an experience, the experience will not outlast your knowledge. All experiences are changing. The experience can overwhelm your knowledge, it won't outlast your knowledge. Now the experience will settle down and then you go, boy, that one sure took me. That one sure took me for a ride. I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to have my buddhi back. You know, that's what happens. But there comes a time, and you notice it in yourself, that the world's capacity to do that becomes less and less and less. Your mind's capacity to catch you like that becomes less and less and less. And then, for you, the world is happy, that it's positive or negative, the situation's positive or negative. The vrittis are positive or negative. The complexes are, are up. But you know how to care for them. When the buddhi is holding them and caring for them, it's not a problem. Just like if the buddhi is holding and you're caring and holding for someone. What if you're, caretaking, an ill person, or caretaking, a mentally disturbed person, or you're caretaking somebody who's problematic. You're caretaking. You're caring for them. That's your job. You have objectivity. You're a caretaker for that person. You're trying to help. That's how it becomes toward your mind and toward your complexes. And then those complexes are like Dugda Bija. They're like burnt seeds. Because you have space. There's space between you and the complex. There's a relationship between you and the complex. Just like what if you have space and objectivity toward the difficult things that manifest in your life, which will go through the whole life. It's not, as we've said, it's not like you get knowledge and Bhagavan rewards you with just one long sukhavritti. You get as your reward. Now that you've done this, it's the end game, in chess it's the end game. Now you've accomplished all of this, and so from this point on, I think I'll just I'll make the creation shine for you. No, the prarabdha, the life goes on. Life goes on. But, the atma shines. Our self is free. And so reveling in that self, you are experiencing your prarabdha, whatever it may be. Whatever it may be. There's no rule that says, now that you gain knowledge, your lifestyle will be like this. Now that you gain knowledge, your station in life will be like this. There's no such rule at all. But it's just that now that you have gained knowledge, that you have nishtha, you will always be in me and I will always be in you. And nobody can take that away. So that's, he's talking about the pulla. Now, let's go to this next verse.
Atmalpanyena sarvatra. Atmalpanyena sarvatra. Samam pashati yorajana. Samam pashati yorajana. Sukham va yadi va dukham. Sukham va yadi va dukham. Sayogi paramo mataha. Sayogi paramo mataha.
Atma alpamyena sarvatra samam pashati yaha arjuna. Sukham va yadiva dukham. Saha yogi paramaha mataha. Here it says, some people, sometimes they bring up this doubt for this verse. There will be two ways we'll be looking at this verse. But the doubt could be, okay, if no matter what the situation is, no matter what happens, You know, the yogi, the one who has jnana nishtha, always abides in me, always abides seeing the oneness and seeing, you know, me and all beings. And no matter what is going on in the universe, what is happening, whatever the situation was with what might be, that yogi always remains in me. Then somebody can say, well, you know, what if he's a dharmic? What if that yogi commits a dharma or is a mean person or cruel? You know, then what happens? Can the yogi do all of that, you know? Would that happen for a yogi? Mm. So there's different ways of looking at that. So here's one way. He says, Atma Upamyena means with the Atma as an Upama. Upama means an example. With the self as an example, or with the self as the point of comparison. An upama also is like if you say, my life is like a ship. My life is like a ship with the wind at its sails or something like that. You know, I'm using some sort of an analogy. Sometimes we use upama with that. It's like a comparison where I compare myself to something else. Or if I say, maybe if you say like the Atma is like the sun. Right, that's a type of a comparison. The Atma is like the sun. The Atma is like space. We use these type of comparisons all the time. So here, what about when the Atma itself is the upama? The Atma itself is the point of reference. So let's see what they say. Then, hey Arjuna, he says, Yaha Pashati, the one who sees Samam Sarvatra. Sarvatra means everywhere. The one who sees the samam, that which is the same everywhere. See, that which is the same everywhere, we had this in a previous verse now, that which is the same everywhere is only the Atma, is only the self, the sat-chit. That's the only thing. The Atma is the only thing that is the same everywhere. Everything else is infinitely divisible. Everything else is different from everything else on every single level. Whether you go infinitely small or infinitely big, there is nothing which is samam. There is nothing which is the same. So that one who sees that which is the same everywhere. You know, so take that for now. Then it says, sukham va yadi va dukham. Whether it be sukha or dukkha, the one in the experience, in every experience that you have, everywhere, the one who sees the same, whether it be a sukha experience or a dukkha experience also, the one who sees that which is samam, with the atma as the upamam. So the samam, well, let me just give the two different ways of taking this. If I've recognized the Atma, going back to the previous verse, as that ekatvam, if I've recognized that in myself, if I've recognized the conscious being in myself, no matter what the experience may be, whether it be sukha or dukkha, that conscious being remains the same. So that's not something, that's the non-variable. So that means then, I see all beings in myself and myself in all beings. So that's the constant, that's the summum. So the one who sees that, recognizes that in every situation, whether it be sukha or dukkha. Okay? So that's the one side of the verse. Everybody see that? So whether sukha or dukkha, whatever the situation, the Atma remains free. Then again, in terms of dharma, the one who sees in every situation the Atma and recognizes in reference to sukha and dukkha, judges sukha and dukkha only in reference to myself, which is dharma, which is the golden rule. In other words, what I would want in that situation, now here's the Atma, they're using the apa, Atma Alpamya. What I would want in that situation, if I cease your dukkha, if I see your dukkha, how would I, that's my dukkha. I'm the self of that dukkha. How would I want to be treated in that situation? Right? Because how would I, if that were my dukkha, how would I want to be treated? It's your dukkha. You are me. Yourself is myself. So now, here in this jiva upadhi, if there's dukkha, what is the response? What is the response for the dukkha? Well, that response, using myself as the comparison, is the way that I will treat you, because I am you. You're a manifestation of my being. You are me, in fact. And so in sukha also, that you're enjoying that sukha, that's a pleasurable situation. How would I want to be treated in that situation? That is what's natural to me, right? So take like this. Really, it's really worthy of, this little thing is really worthy of some contemplation. I'm just trying to get it in a visual for you, for myself, so that I can explain it more. If I see all beings as myself, if I have that ekatvam, right, there's a couple of things that are happening. One is, my mind is enjoying my own being. Because I'm awake to my own being. So that's where I'm sitting. That's where that astitaha, that's where I'm remaining. I'm sitting in my own fullness, in my own ananda. Okay? If I'm sitting in my own ananda, I'm not asking you to make me happy. Right? Because I'm sitting in the ananda itself. I don't need you to make me happy. And so if I don't need you to make me happy, then I can be objective towards you. I can accept you as you are, because I'm not asking you to make me happy. And so now, in the situations of the world, there are sukha and dukkha. There are pleasurable situations, there are painful situations. It's the nature of the creation. Even for me as a jnani, there are sukha situations, dukkha situations. That's the way of the world for all beings, for animals, for humans, for plants, for the creation as a whole. The whole creation, in fact, in the Katha Upanishad, they use the example of death being the chutney for the whole creation. Death is the chutney because it goes on eating itself. It goes on changing. Everything is continually being eaten, continually being, you know, destroyed. So every situation that there is continually being destroyed, being turned over, being cultivated, you know, like cultivating the earth is being turned over and cultivated and changed into something else. That's the nature of this infinite manifestation. And so say if you want anything out of it, you're in trouble because it is in continually being changed, continually being eaten, continually being cultivated. And so that means that there's going to be pain. Because even on a physical level, your body also is being cultivated. It has death as its chutney. It's all, everything is in constant change. And so now, here we are. All of us are only the Atma. And all of us also have this jiva upadhi. We all have bodies. We all have minds. We all have sense organs. And so the creation is a particular way that has a particular order. And the jiva upadhi has certain needs. Like it has a need, it needs food to survive. It needs air. It needs water. It needs shelter. There's all of these, you know, basic things that are necessary. On a psychological level, it needs mirroring. The human being needs to be mirrored. It needs to be appreciated. It needs to be respected. You know, it's like oxygen for the soul. Right? These things, you know. And so you, whether as a jnani, say you have jnana nishtha, you're aware of all of these things. You're aware that the body needs to eat, and it needs to have water, and it needs to have protection, you know. And it appreciates being appreciated. All of it is just human. And so that's the nature of Ishwara. That's Ishwara. It's the nature of the Upadhi. Yeah? And it's not fun to not be mirrored. It's not fun to be, you know, criticized or disliked or to be looked at with distrust. All of these things, these are painful. These are painful things. They're meant to cause pain. And so, once your mind is awake to yourself and that freedom is there, how is it natural for you to treat others? What is natural in the way that you treat others? What is natural is to treat others in the way that you want to be treated. Because you are the barometer. You see what I mean? You are the example. We are all. This is, as Swamiji says in his book, this is simple dharma. You are the example for how to treat others. Because it's very obvious to you. You know, what is the proper way for you to be treated? So in that, and this is the basic dharma, it becomes natural. It's absolutely natural for a human being to do that, to treat others as you want to be treated. It's not something that you really have to think about. It's, in a sense, it's a no-brainer. It's natural and spontaneous. Unless and until you have a particular need out here to be happy. And then that need will conflict with what is spontaneous for you. The spontaneous ahimsa, the spontaneous goodness, the spontaneous wanting to help, just as you would want to be helped. You know, that's all spontaneous until it conflicts with a need. But to the degree that those needs aren't there for your own ananda, that spontaneous way of behavior is what is natural. So dharma becomes natural for you, because you're not asking others or the creation to be different. And so you become the upama, you become the example for your behavior. And so no, you will not be a dharmic, because a dharma is even not available to you as an ajnani when you're not wanting anything. You don't act adharmically when you're not wanting anything. The dharma is not your nature. Dharma is your nature. Except when you're ignorance bound. Then the adharma comes in. So what's being said is that dharmic behavior is natural. No, you will not hurt others with any intention. You may hurt others, but not with an intention. You know? And if you hurt others with an intention, it's because that jiva's head has popped up. Because of my raga dvesha. The jiva has popped up. That's what, okay, that becomes my sadhana. But when the jiva's head isn't popped up, there's just Ishwara there and all beings are myself. And so on one level, I am, how do I treat all other beings is how I want to be treated, which is just the natural dharma. The other way of taking the other slant on the verse is simply that whether the situation is sukha or dukkha, I see all beings in myself. So just as he says, the one who sees everywhere the same as the self, who sees everything as the self, whether sukha or dukkha, it doesn't make any difference. I recognize myself as the self. It just comes down to this. Everywhere, at all times, in all situations, whether it be positive or negative, I recognize my being as the self of that situation. That being is that's the summum. Everywhere that summum is there. Summum means sameness. The sameness of myself, but my being, is there untouched. And that being, whether it's sukha, whether the situation is sukha or dukkha, there's no sukha or dukkha in reference to me. There's a sukha situation, a dukkha situation, but there's not a sukha self or a dukkha self. I remain, I'm always the same. And so that is what's aparoksha to me. If you think there's a sukha self and a dukkha self, then you're again, you're mistaking a vritti, a thought modification, to be the Atma. That viveka between your being that illumines the vritti and the vritti hasn't taken place yet. And so then you're looking for sukha vrittis. When the sukha vrittis are there, then the Atma is shining. When the dukkha vrittis are there, the Atma is not shining. That simply is not true. That means I'm taking my looking for the Atma in the vritti, rather than recognizing the Atma as the changeless self of all vrittis. I'm looking for the Atma to manifest in a particular type of vritti. Like, let me have a sukha vritti so the Atma can manifest. Was the Atma there before the sukha vritti or not? Was your self present as the self of the dukkha vritti, the neutral vritti, and the sukha vritti? Were you there, present to all of those vrittis? You have to say, yes, I was there. Then you need to recognize the nature of that one who is there, regardless of the vritti. That one is changeless, it is aparoksha, that is me. That is the ananda. So the one who recognizes that, right, wherever, whatever the vritti is, and wherever it is, whatever the experience, sarvatra means everywhere, that which is the same, that atma, which is the same, no matter what the vritti, that the one who sees that atma there, myself there, recognizes myself there in all of the different situations, then he says, saha yogi paramaha matta, that yogi is supreme in my opinion. Mataha. I consider, he said, Krishna says, I consider that yogi to be paramaha. That one who, no matter what the experience, you know, sees that which is the same. No matter what the experience, sees the samam, sees that which is the same. Just myself for the upama. I am the one that is recognized in every single experience. I am the one who is related to every single experience. Okay. That one truly is the Parama Yogi. That one is the highest yogi. Because that's the truth, Satyam Mithya. The whole manifest creation is Mithya. I am the Satyam. The mind that sees that to the degree that the Mithya can't kind of squash the Mithya Jagat can't squash the Mithya mind. Can't overwhelm the Mithya Jagat, the Mithya world, can't overwhelm the Mithya Buddhi, right? To make it feel like it's become remote from Ishvara, remote from the self. It simply does not have the capacity to do that anymore. That's Jnana Nishtha. And that Nishtha comes in time, you know? It comes in time. I gain knowledge, and then my mind matures. It matures in a number of different ways. It matures, first of all, in terms of its clarity, because for a while I gain knowledge, I see, but then I have doubts. And so the mind has to mature in reference to all of those doubts and those areas that I'm not clear, I don't know. I run into like a boulders. So the mind has to mature in terms of its clarity, you know. And then it has to mature emotionally in terms of vairagya, in terms of raga dvesha. It has to mature. Because I start out with my own collection of likes and dislikes. My own personal collection of complexes tailored only to me. And these complexes I need to learn how to be with, so that they can also mature and grow, and I can have a distance on them, a relation. Distance on them, I mean a relationship with them. That's what I mean by distance, rather than being overwhelmed by them. So this takes place in time. You know, that's why the little tree needs a little fence around it. You know, because it takes time for the mind, which has been through beginningless lifetimes of samsara, And then the lifetime of samsara up till this moment, you know, it takes time for the mind to be able to sort out all of this, all of these experiences that are have the ahankara as its core. It has ajnanam with the I notion as its core. It takes time for all of that confusion to sort itself out in the light of your knowledge. And that becomes actually a very, very beautiful journey. That maturity becomes a very beautiful journey. You know, especially, you know, after some time when some of the really rough ride is over. It becomes a very, very, very beautiful, very enjoyable journey as I watch my mind mature and flower into owning up this knowledge. All the while having knowledge, I watch my mind mature into owning that knowledge and gaining that nishta. So here these two verses are kind of in praise of nishta and in praise of just getting understanding also the means of meditation, how to meditate and all of these things. Now after this, we'll see this next week, Arjuna has listened to all of this, and then he asks Krishna a question. He says something like, "Yeah, but you know, my mind's pretty tumultuous. How am I gonna make this mind that's always moving? I don't know how to make it settle down." So he's gonna ask Krishna two questions, two verses, ask some questions, and then we go into kind of a final discussion here. So let's stop here. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. What I was talking about is when you have, this is kind of psychology, but these complexes carry a lot of energy that even allow them to come up and overwhelm the ego, you know, overwhelm the conscious mind, you know. And when you come into relationship with these complexes and you become an inner friend to them and kind of understand and listen to them, all this inner dialogue, and was this one way of working with them. what happens is that they get a lot of the energy that's been held in the unconscious associated with this particular complex, where it releases back into, it's called libido, it releases back into the conscious mind. And you actually feel, you know, you actually feel that process happening as you work with some of these complexes, especially with some love and kindness and objectivity and understanding. They will actually slowly kind of, from this is all kind of Jungian language, but they'll kind of reunite with the main conscious mind, with the main ego, from a psychological ego. And so, you know, even when for people who do body work, so much energy, so much of the unconscious is even held in the body. And there's all just all kinds of techniques for releasing the energy that these complexes have. And then what you find is you can still have, especially complexes that are picked up when you're young, you can still have kind of the structure of that complex inside, but it doesn't have the energy. So it's very, very handleable, and it can just be kind of part of your personality, but not something that takes you away or fills you with pain, you know. Sometimes they liken, Jung has likened it to, like, say if you have a boil that goes kind of deep underneath the skin. And once that boil, and so it's painful, and if you were to touch it, you know, it's painful. But once that boil is lanced, and then you can press it, you know, and it's a pain, but there's a pleasure in the pain as you're releasing all of the, you know, toxins from the boil. And then that boil can heal, so that there's no pain at all. But there's still the little scar there, you know, from the boil. So it leaves its little mark. So I think all of our complexes and life experiences, they leave the structure, they go to making the structure of the psyche. But as you work through some of the complex, the hurt part, you still keep the same structure, but it's not full of that energy that can overwhelm you. So it becomes very handleable. It also becomes part of your character. And all of those experiences lead to you develop your character and your compassion and your empathy and your understanding of the experiences that others have. You know, if you didn't have any wrinkles, so to speak, you know, it's like you wouldn't understand. You would be, kind of odd to think about it. Without any, there's been no pain in your life, no complexes, no challenges, no having to deal with sorrow or suffering or dukkha of any kind, you would be kind of a weird bird in the world. Where would your empathy be? It'd be odd. So you learn a lot from your suffering.
So you shouldn't be disappointed if some of these patterns persist, you know?
No, it's not about being disappointed. It's about learning how to be with them to help them grow. Mm-hmm. Like some patterns will stay your whole life because they make up your character and who you are, and you are kind of a product of your experience from the standpoint of the jiva. But so the thing is, does the pattern cause pain? And is it ridden with, you know, that kind of painful energy? Then we need to be with it in a way that can help that energy to be released. And then you still might have that tendency. Mm-hmm. Like, say, because of your experience, you've always been, you know, because of your personality and also because of your upbringing, so many things, you've always been a loner. Mm-hmm. Then, say, you work through all of these, you know, personality complexes and whatnot, and you gain knowledge and you have nishta, you're still a loner.
That won't change.
It's not like you become some, you know,
special. You're not going to
social butterfly.
Become gregarious
and
go to parties.
But you're happy.
Yeah, you're just a, you know, much more content loner.
So you shouldn't work on trying to get rid of it.
only the part that needs mirroring and understanding. Because otherwise, you're carrying around inside of you these hurts where there's nobody to mirror. Because some of these, to mirror you, because some of these hurts take place when you're a child. And now you have a little child inside an adult body. We all do. Well, the adults are mirroring the adult. Like, I'm talking to Edward, I'm not talking to the little 3-year-old Edward. So the little 3-year-old Edward is saying, well, you know, what about me? But the adults don't see that person. So I sometimes, therapy is really helpful, because the therapist does see. They make a point of seeing, you know, and addressing that and having room for that and teaching you how to take care of those parts of yourself. And, you know, because the adult, you can go and be with those younger parts and bring them up, you know, with love and kindness and respect and care. But the outside world doesn't necessarily, doesn't see. They're talking to you, the adult. And even if you, the adult, are being overwhelmed at the moment by a 3-year-old, they're only seeing you, the adult, who's acting like a 3-year-old. They don't understand. Your therapist may understand. Most people just think, you know, you're a grown man. What are you doing? You know? They don't all of a sudden change and say, oh, honey, don't worry.
Oh, they never do that.
No. No. Because they don't see. But you can learn to see. Mm-hmm. You can see inside of yourself that 3-year-old's taken over. You know, or the 5-year-old has taken over, or the teenager's taken over. And you can say, you, the adult, you can say, okay, I hear you. Tell me all about it. Don't worry about this, I'll take care of it. Whatever way you talk to, you can talk to those young parts inside. Then they feel heard. They'll eventually, you know, if you give them that kind of care, they'll assimilate back into the ego. They're split off. You know? So that's one, there are many ways of working with this. This is one way I work with it with my patients, and I like it. I've worked with it with myself also. It's what's helped me. There's other systems for doing the same type of work.
Because, you know, like the 13-year-old will say, well, you know, I want you to come back in and fill in where you got hurt and what they did to you and that kind of stuff.
But you can fill in. You can let the 13-year-old tell all of the things, all of the complaints. And then you can say, yeah, I know, that was really hard, I understand. And then you can offer, you know, You can be the father. You know, you can offer the help and advice, but only after they've said everything they have to say. It's really nice to learn how to be with yourself, to be in relationship with the different parts of your mind, to be in relationship with your unconscious, and to learn how to be kind.
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, those experiences, it's like a movie. You want to go back and play out the part again and have it better.
But you can do that, actually. That's another technique that you can actually go back and, you know, imagine it first, relive it as it was, and then reimagine it as you would like it to be. Mm-hmm. That's also a nice exercise. There's a lot of different ways of doing this type of thing. Focusing, what Tomas does, it's another good way. So there's different ways, but if you understand it, they all have something similar, you know, about coming into relationship.
But are all in the light of the Atma.
But we're using this in the light as a means for antikarana shuddhi, for taking care of complexes. That's very useful in the light of your knowledge.
Yeah. You know, when Tibby comes running down the hallway during the meditation, it sounds like there's a herd of animals coming, not just one little kitten.
Is it that tends to, is there, do you have some understanding of what it is that blocks these complexes from our knowing? Like, how is it that, what's...
Because of the emotion. You know, emotion is more real than the thought. Like the emotion of pain, you know, the emotions overwhelm the mind. Yeah. So that's why if you have the emotion, the emotion will overwhelm the mind. And then what you can do is talk to the emotion. Because the emotion really is the complex overwhelming the mind. And then if you talk to the emotion, come in dialogue with the emotion, then the buddhi is back. Right? And then there's somebody holding and relating to the emotion. And then there's space again. You are holding, relating to the emotion. Then you have yourself back, your knowledge back, your wisdom back, and somebody who's useful and helpful, an inner friend to the complex or the emotion. That's why that's so helpful, because otherwise I'm just overwhelmed by the emotion, because that's what a complex does. It rises up and overwhelms the mind, and then I become that. You know? Like, I am the hurt person, I am the angry person, I am that. Its emotions are very powerful. But this bringing the buddhi in this dialogue, especially with that kindness, inner friend, then that emotion, the complex, gets healed, gets cared for. It just needs some mirroring, it needs some love. And then it can work itself. These problems can work themselves out. But problems don't work themselves out without love. They just get worse. You know, they get more hurt. You know, because then they feel, you know, criticized, or you don't care about me. Say if you have a complex coming up, and then your buddhi says, "Oh no, not you again." Not you again. Go back to your room.
Get the hell out of here.
And so then that is re-traumatizing.
Yeah.
As opposed to being a good mother, you know, being caring, whatever image works for you, being the Swami. You know.
Radha, I'm taking an Enneagram class for 6 weeks. Is that a helpful type of thing to work on these complexes? That system?
I don't know enough about it. I know that a lot of people like that. I've never really studied it. You know, I know that, you know, some people are 7, some people are 8, and all that. I had somebody gave me the
I'm
book.
65.
I don't have the book anymore. But, you know, if people have found it useful, if I studied it, I'd probably find it useful too. But I don't know enough about it. John, Swamiji, in a few verses back, he talks about all of the different ways that the yogi, the word yogi is used. One, it's used as a karma yogi. Another is one who meditates. A meditator is called a yogi. And the third one is the jnani. Is the yogi. So it's used in different ways. There's one section not too far back where he really discusses that in the Bhagavad Gita home study. Those are the three basic ways, and you have to look in the context to see which way he's using it. There's other words like that. They're like, you know, like how he uses the word atma. Sometimes atma means the mind or the body or the self. It just depends on context. Yogis like that. So does the Upanishad use it that way too? I don't know. I'd have to look at the verse. It's not one way that it's being used. It's by context. Meditator, karma yogi, or jnani?
The Gita always seems to be good with these things, you know.
Oh. Should we stop? Still early.
When you're done, you're done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll have to send you a picture of her, Catherine. Maybe I'll put a picture on the website. Everybody can see little Tiggy.
Shifting slowly to a different subject altogether.
Well, I learn a lot from Tibby. Amazing how much animals teach you. They're so pure. You know, so simple in some ways.
Well, she loves to be loved, it seems like, you know.
Like we all do.
Yeah. I do.
There was something you were saying about when one's needs are satisfied, or there was something in the verse that it allows one to...
You're naturally dharmic.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems so true, and that seems to be why in times when basic needs are not as widely fulfilled, like when people are becoming unemployed or people are losing their housing.
That's right. They're under stress and
yeah,
be reacting because, yeah.
So almost as if it's like as if there was a mass confusion or a greater forgetting of the self.
Well, it's certainly, your mind is going to be much more stressed and in pain, right?
Yeah.
But that's not your nature.